I've been following Buster Benson for years online. His journaling platform, 750words.com, has been a part of my writing process since really before the inception of the meaning movement. Something that's always spoken to me about Buster's work is, first, how he works to create tools that help people improve themselves, improve the world. And secondly, that he's always working on projects. He's not one to sit around, and I just really resonate with that approach to life. His most recent work is a book about the importance of disagreements and how to make them productive. In our interview, we dig into Buster's work, all the projects that he's done, and we do a deep dive into how to make disagreements something more than arguments. I loved connecting with Buster. He's just an inspiration in doing such important work. I hope you'll enjoy our conversation as much as I did. This, of course, is the Meaning Movement podcast, a show about work worth doing. I'm your host, Dan Cumberland, today with entrepreneur, developer, product leader, and author, Buster Benson. Stay with us. Can you imagine waking up on Monday mornings excited about your day? Can you imagine loving being asked the question, "So, what do you do?" I created the Calling Course with a single goal in mind: to create a resource for finding what's next. The Calling Course is based on the process I developed through working with people around the big career transitions that we all go through. I went so far as to get a master's degree in psychology and culture to bring this concept to life, and I'd like to invite you to consider joining us. If you've ever felt stuck, if you've ever felt uncertain of what's next, if you've ever felt like you want more from your work, but you're not sure how to get it, I made this for you. Join us. Get started for free today with a mini course called 5 Clues to Your Calling at thecallingcourse.com. I'll see you there. Buster, thank you so much for joining me today. Welcome to the Meaning Movement podcast.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
So the question I like to begin with, as you know, is how do you begin to talk about what you do?
This is a great question because my mom always asked me this question. and I've practiced this answer, you know, for 20 years plus. never satisfactorily. So let me give it a try. I like to think about solving my own problems first and foremost, and I have many, but the one that really grabs me that has sort of followed me as a thread throughout my career in tech and in entrepreneurship and in writing has been, how do we change ourselves? How do we use the tools that we have in our, like the software in our head, to improve ourselves, to see the world more clearly? And so that becomes sort of the jumping point for almost all of my projects. Sort of how do we use the world as a mirror? How do we use conversation and critical thinking as tools to understand the world and ourselves better? And so that's a pretty broad jumping off point, but it's the one that is the foundation of everything I try to do.
I love it. I love it. I guess a good kind of maybe place to dig into that is, what has that looked like? What are some of the projects that have been manifest through that lens?
Yeah. So I've had a few startups. One of them was 43 Things, which was a goal-making website. So trying to use the internet early days, like 2003, to make a list of goals publicly and connect you with other people with those goals in the service of, like,
I love it.
Maybe other people can help you. And once you do it, you can help other people do it. There was another one called Habit Labs and Health Month, which was about zeroing in on behavior change specifically. Like, how do I use the internet to help me change my own habits and my own behaviors And that startup was around 2010-ish. And then there's 750 Words, which is a website that's still around, almost turning 10 this year. And it's a private journaling website. So you try to get into the flow state with private journaling and just brain dump everything. And I provide analytics and streaks and other things to motivate you to write every day, because that's one of the habits that I have found to be the most rewarding long term, in terms of just understanding what's in my head.
Yeah.
And I've also been a product manager. So, you know, the day job has been, you know, engineer, designer, product manager, most recently at companies like Amazon, Twitter, Slack, and Patreon. And each of those companies has been about using technology to somehow hopefully improve our lives and connect us better and make us more productive, make us, you know, enjoy life more. And most recently, I've moved to writing a book called Why Are We Yelling, which is about using the art of productive disagreement as a way to have livelier conversations, to build our relationships, to enjoy life more. So those are a bunch of things.
I love it. It's a great legacy that you're creating. And I think, you know, one thing that really stands out to me of just how you've, you know, answered that question is that, you know, of the projects that you listed, your day job is kind of what came last on the list.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm curious, I don't know, have you always had lots of irons in the fire? Have you always just been attracted to having lots of things going at once?
I go through cycles. So I go through cycles of having too many projects and then the cycles of not having enough. Right now I'm actually in the low dip of the cycle with, I got one major project and I'm trying to keep it that way for a while and let it sort of sit there.
Yeah.
I don't last long with lots of projects, but I use that lots of project stage as a way to try lots of things and see what works and then remove the things that don't work and stick with the ones that do.
Yeah.
And yeah, so, but yeah, I definitely go through stages and have burnt out multiple times in my career.
I can imagine. I can imagine because I've been there too, because I think I share that, share that bias with you. Mm-hmm. So has tech always been kind of your trajectory? Like from an early age, did you know that you wanted to be, you know, involved in creating software, working on computers, you know, those kinds of things?
Absolutely not. No. In fact, it was my last choice. I think when I was growing up, my father was a computer engineer. You know, he was a CTO at, you know, a database company back in the day. My grandfather was an engineer in aerospace and built like, you know, self-flying planes and laser-guided missiles and things like that for the government. And so I was, you know, the rebellion. I want to be a poet and a painter, and I wanted to like write a novel. And so I had this fight with them, you know, more with my grandfather than my father. My father was like, just do what you love. You know, my grandfather was like, computers are the only path you can take. You must take it, you know, or you will regret it. And so I was like, hell no, I'm not going to do that. Yeah. And then it wasn't until graduating from college with a creative writing degree that I looked in the paper, like, okay, what are my jobs? You know, and I saw a copy editor position at Amazon, and I was currently at, you know, a guard at the Seattle Art Museum. So that was, you know, the job I quit. And everyone was like, hey, you know, if this doesn't work out with the internet, you know, you can always come back and be a guard at the museum. It's like, sweet. Yes. Okay. This would be great. But then once joining Amazon, I saw like this whole other world. And like blogging was beginning to take off. This was like 1998.
Yeah.
And I was just enamored by the whole thing and applied all of that creative energy towards tech, which has always been my strong suit. And, you know, later on sort of falling into the generalist category and sort of trying to survive in a world of increasingly crowded specialists for every single possible thing. But yeah, that's, you know, I'm not a native of the internet. I'm more of a, you know, I was lucky in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. Interesting. So along the way, I know that you're a product manager by day, or at least have been. What are some of the titles that you've held along the way?
Yeah. So I started off as a customer support agent, you know, on the night shift at Amazon. Then I was a trainer, you know, training other support agents. Then I was a web developer. I talked my way into like getting a web developer job in the other big building. Then I was a software engineer. Then I was a technical product program manager. Then I was a designer. And that was my tenure at Amazon. And then I started a startup. So I was a CTO of the robot co-op and had a number of sort of vague titles in startup land where they don't really exist in concrete form. And then, you know, 10 years later, when I had to get a job again, I got a job as senior software engineer at Twitter. And I moved into product management from there.
Cool.
And then product manager from there on, so like from like, you know, entry level to like sort of director level, and resisting every single promotion because I didn't want to. I always wanted to be in the ground, like, you know, getting my hands dirty with the engineers and the designers. So that's my happy place.
I love it. It's a cool and kind of inspiring journey that, like,
it's a wandering path. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a wandering path. But I think that, you know, the story I had made up in my head about you is that you were a developer from the day you were born, and that's what you're doing now. And so it's really, really fun for me to kind of fill out the picture and find that it's actually much more interesting than I had assumed.
So, yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
I like to complicate the narrative. That's my main goal. So as long as that's achieved.
I think that's what's important. You know, people listening are typically in some sort of a complicated narrative themselves. And so to hear stories like yours and to say, okay, there's not a linear path.
No.
One person's career path is not someone else's. And so I think it's great. It's great to hear. Great to see. As you made those transitions, and whether those be, I don't know if you want to answer this from the standpoint of your projects or from your job, or if, you know, I don't know how much those kind of interweave for you, but like, what are some of the questions that you ask to help you understand when it's time to make a move and make a change?
Yeah, I mean, that's an easy one. I always ask, you know, what can I learn? Like, and what am I learning? What am I mastering? What am I done learning? And then always thinking about it in the long term of, like, you know, I'm just trying to create this life of mine where I have sort of a breadth of skills and then experiences that can be used together, that sort of have connections with each other. And so it often encourages me to try something different if I've hit a wall of, like, knowing my job too well. And most of the time I quit my job, so usually like, oh yeah, I see the roadmap for a year and a half going forward, and I sort of know how to do that, so I'm going to change. And so I think a lot about, you know, just acquiring skills, acquiring learning, and acquiring sort of a different perspective from that, and hoping that, like, each time I add one skill to the toolbox, I get, you know, more than one amount, like more than that in return, in terms of, like, seeing how these different skills interact with one another, sort of being able to find the connections, skip the inefficient connections between them. Cause oftentimes, you know, when you get really specialized, you have to create an interface between every single skill, and each of those interfaces creates delay and lag and debt and all these other things. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. As, you know, people are listening, they're often in similar, you know, places where they're wondering about, you know, is it time to make that move? Is it time to leave what I'm doing now, to step out? I'm curious if you have any thoughts that you would offer to people that are, you know, kind of contemplating the leap.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite. So I do offer, like, if someone's in a hard decision, I'm always like, okay, let's talk for an hour and figure out, you know, what your options are and sort of how to think about it. Because I love that question. I love that problem because, first of all, because usually the mistakes we make in that situation are pretty common. We make the same kinds of mistakes where we narrow it down immediately to two options, and then spend a lot of time considering those two options. And what I like to do is to take those two, sort of understand what the values are behind them and how they sort of speak to different values, and then use those values to produce a lot more options.
Interesting.
And from there, saying, like, okay, well, you want to have something that's going to help you grow in this. You've found one way to do that. What are other ways to do that? Just to, like, open the box a little bit and help you realize that it's not a this or that answer. It's more of a choose your own adventure, and also, like, create your own adventure, because when you only have two, you have to, like, really deliberate it. When you have 1,000 options, you have to come up with a framework to decide. And it often comes to the case that, like, you know, 10 of them or even 15 of them are all going to be okay, and they're all going to be good, and it's what you make of it.
Yeah.
So that's freeing to a lot of people to then say, like, okay, well, yeah, I see how it's really in my control versus, like, what do I not know? What am I going to, like, what mistakes am I going to make? What regrets am I going to have? And seeing it as, like, a bigger picture.
I love that. It really, really, really speaks to me also about, like, it's almost like a process of, instead of looking at, you know, what are the options on the table, you know, what's out there in front of me, and then making a decision solely based on that, to then, you know, kind of look more inward into where else could this go?
Yeah.
Which it just feels really freeing, really freeing process, and much less backed into a corner.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the things that, you know, continue to surprise me in a lot of these problems that I'm trying to solve is that we often get to a point where we feel stuck. And it's usually because we've narrowed it down to a small number of options and none of them seem good. Mm. And so they all seem like trade-offs and sort of black boxes to us. And just the act of seeing like, where do these answers come from? This is where like my thoughts around bias and systems thinking have really so helped me think of the bigger picture, because our biases are really about narrowing down options. And we can sort of look at the bias of like, you know, favoring familiar things or sunk cost or like really only picking out the things that are available to us if we think about it. And then work backwards from that and think about, okay, well, what have I missed? What am I not considering that I should consider? And using other people as mirrors to come up with more options, to see it from a different perspective, to have more conversations, to just go into the exploratory phase a bit versus the selection phase.
Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah, and so I know you've been doing some work around cognitive biases, and I guess you know this would be a good time to just talk a little bit more about your book, which ties into that, which is Why Are We Yelling? The Art of Productive Disagreement, which is fantastic. Lots I want to pick your brain about related to that. But just to kind of dig into cognitive biases for a moment, can you even just define that more fully for us? Like, what is a cognitive bias?
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways to define it. The one that I find the most easy to understand in a short period is like biases are sort of apps in our brains that have been installed over time through evolution to help us make choices.
Yeah.
And oftentimes they make choices with as little energy as possible so that we can do other things with our energy, because our brain is very, you know, high, takes a lot of energy to run. Mm-hmm. So it's doing these things in the background saying that, okay, well, we got to make a choice. Let's, even before we let the conscious mind know, let's just eliminate 80% first. And so what things that it does, there's three functions primarily. One of them is to filter out options, you know, filter out information, because otherwise we'd be overwhelmed by everything, to help us connect the dots and make something meaningful, to tell a story about it. So connecting it to our the rest of our constellation of meanings in our head. Mm. And then also the third one is what to do and how to do it. Like what is the action we can take based on the story and based on this information that will get us to the goal as quickly as possible. So if you take those three buckets, they're really hard problems to solve. Like there's no way we'll ever be able to process all the information in the universe. There's no way we'll ever be able to tell the perfect story about what's happening. And there's no way we'll ever be able to choose the perfect action based on all of that. And so we have to take these shortcuts. Mm. And that's what the biases do. They do it in a low energy kind of way. And so they actually give us the ability to survive in the world at the same time as they create these blind spots. And those blind spots are systemic and, you know, consistent. So over time, the kind of debt and the mistakes that you make will be similar to the other ones you've made, and it will create another problem that you'll have to deal with later on. And so we have to be mindful of that too.
I love it. Could you, I don't know, I'm putting you on the spot a little bit with this question, but could you give us a some examples?
Yeah. So one that everyone's familiar with is, you know, confirmation bias, where, you know, we're looking around and we only see like a tiny fraction of the universe when we're looking around based on sort of what we're looking for. Yeah. And we pick out the thing that we're looking for and we ignore everything else. And the things that we're not looking at are the things that would be a problem for us. You know, the things that disconfirm our beliefs or that would be inconsistent or complicate the situation. So that's a very famous one, I suppose.
Yeah.
One of the ones that I like to talk about is naive realism, because this is sort of a class of biases that I think is really applicable to today's like sort of political conversation and national conversation around like when we run into someone and they say something that doesn't make sense to us, we will interpret that as them being dumb, right? Or them being, them not understanding or seeing the world as clearly as we do. And it causes us, and this is something that you might've heard people say before, is like, I can't believe why you would ever do this. You must be an idiot, right? Like the conclusion is you're an idiot because I can't understand why you would do this.
Yep.
Although the alternative to that could be, I can't believe why you would do this. Can you tell me sort of how that came about, where these beliefs came from, where these actions came from, and help me understand your perspective on this? And that naive realism is the thing that makes us project, you know, and say like, oh, my projection of this person is correct and I don't have to ask them to correct me. And that's, you know, incredibly damaging and harmful long-term if we continue to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like the some of the invitation with the cognitive biases and becoming more aware of biases is one is to, you know, note that they're important and necessary, but then secondly, to be aware of those blind spots and I guess just more aware of when you're using them and to make sure that you want to be using them in those situations.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I try to, I mean, I get this question a lot, which is like, you know, how do I become less biased? And, you know, often my answer at this point is like, don't try to become less biased directly because your brain is not designed to do that task. It will convince you that you're not biased way before you ever become unbiased. So the better strategy is to look for damage that your biases have caused and to repair that. And by doing that, you're not directly looking into your own brain. You're looking into the world. Like, okay, well, how did, you know, the way that I handled these situations help make me neglect or undervalue some other options that could have been there? And then do work to help bring some of those neglected options back onto the table and do that repeatedly as sort of in the, like a maintenance mode kind of thing. And you'll then begin to see when you're doing the thing that causes that kind of thing to happen. Indirectly. And it's a little bit less anxiety inducing because nobody likes to like just constantly doubt themselves.
Yeah.
And that can be, you know, for some people, you know, really enough reason not to do it. Right.
Yep. Yep. I love it. I love it. Well, I'd love to just dig in a little bit to Why Are We Yelling, which it's one of my favorite book covers, which I know it's a podcast. You can't see a book cover, but there's like a, I don't know if it's like a gorilla mouth or maybe a hippo with sharp teeth on one side and an alligator's mouth on the other. And it's just really fun. So
yeah,
it's a fantastic, fantastic read. Many, many takeaways. And I know that for myself personally, that I'll be returning to, but I'd love to hear even just, I mean, I think we've already started to talk about it a little bit, but why write a book about disagreement? Where did this come from?
Again, it was a long journey. It started as a book about cognitive biases. The first title I had was Thinking is Hard.
I love that.
My publisher didn't like it as much. And so I changed it. So I feel like I'm trying to understand, like, when do biases become the most sort of important for us to consider? And it always came back to this disagreement. Disagreement is basically the social ritual that biases were perfectly designed for because they're there to help you grab everything that you can to help you win by, you know, pulling all the confirming details, by motivating like overconfidence, all these things that you can do to like help you win that have nothing to do with the actual whether or not you're right. But I decided that by focusing on disagreement, I'm actually focusing on the most applicable and everyday and relatable thing that causes bias. And after Thinking is Hard, it was Arguing is Hard. And they didn't like that one either. And then so Why Are We Yelling was the final, obviously better title that sort of captured that. And it really came out of like, you know, this is something that we all do, you know, every day, almost every single role that we play in life. Like we're always having conversations. And so I saw conversation and the relationship with sort of polarity, like polarization and bias and all these things as like a high leverage area to think about because everyone can benefit from getting 1% better at disagreeing. And as soon as I realized that, I was like, wow, okay, there must be a lot written about this. And I just went everywhere and collected all my notes and sort of saw it through this lens of the art of productive disagreement, which is really just everyday conversations about how do I personally make it practical? I don't need the theory. I don't need the experts telling me what to do necessarily. I need just like, give me the practical stuff. And that's how the book is organized around like 8 things to try, which are basically just conversational habits that can help you practice this. And that was my goal. And
I love it.
It took a long time to get there, but it's, I think it's a useful like toolbox of things to consider.
I couldn't agree more. I think one of the most obvious for you, but I think was really helpful for me is just kind of reframing disagreement as instead of something, I don't know, I guess I should preface this by saying, I know that I'm a very agreeable person. I tend to, you know, I like people to like me. I like to, you know, in conversation, in podcast interviews, align myself with guests as much as I can. Mm-hmm. Like disagreement is not a very comfortable space for me a lot of times. And one of the things that I just thought was really helpful about the book is just how much opportunity there is in disagreement. That disagreement is not necessarily just arguing.
Right.
It's more than that. And just, I don't know, I guess I felt like walking away from the book, like I just felt more, I don't know, more equipped, less scared of disagreement.
Yeah. Yeah. Most people are dread it. You know, like most people consider like, okay, well, if I'm going to disagree, I'm going to come away frustrated and even feeling more stuck than I was going in.
Yeah.
But if you can start to practice it in less, you know, sort of heated places and get sort of build confidence around the skill, you can start to see it as like this opportunity for a really exciting time, right? Like it comes with all the things that like a great game has, like, you know, it's got your blood pressure spikes and your heart rate's all excited. And like, you get to like, you know, sort of confront the unknown and like understand something in a new way. And hopefully, you know, even have fun. Like we all like, experience our disagreements that have been fun.
Yeah.
We don't know what caused that to happen, but I think there are pretty predictable ways to sort of shift it over. And once you see it that way, then suddenly the world is a lot bigger because you can have so many more conversations.
Yeah. I'm curious how in your research and exploration of the topic, even your own interactions were shaped by your study and by your research.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely changed my life. You know, a lot of like, you know, I became the person that could write the book during the process. That's why it took so long.
It sounds like hard work, really hard work.
Cause you know, it's hard to find the right level. You know, most video games and sports are designed to sort of level you up, you know, according to your skill level. Your opportunities are a little bit, the world isn't really structured that way. And so you have to go out and sort of find them and notice them when they occur. Mm. And so what I found was that, you know, first of all, they're everywhere. Second of all, resolving a disagreement isn't always the goal, right? There's many other fruit of disagreement than simply agreeing on something. It could be about learning about the other person's perspective. It could be about building a relationship. It could be about just pure enjoyment. And, you know, alignment could also come out of those things, but it's not the only thing that can come out of it. And as far as how it changed my own life, you know, I started seeing where I was avoiding disagreements and opening up that door a little bit and saying, okay, well, let's have that disagreement. Let's sort of figure out what's going on there. And that actually led to a lot of change in my life, because sometimes the thing on the other side of a disagreement is like quitting a job or like sort of changing the structure of your relationship, or, you know, all these other things that once you sort of open the box, like, wow, I can now design, you know, the outcomes and something is going to change for the better. And, you know, I don't know what it is yet because I haven't really gotten there yet. And I realized how many like boulders in my life there were where I was like, oh yeah, there's something interesting over there. And if I go look at it, something interesting will happen.
Yeah.
And so I really feel like, you know, the superpower that comes out of it is like the world becomes bigger. Like all these locked doors in your life open up. Mm. You can start to meet people that you would never consider meeting. You can start to do things that you never considered doing in a growth sense of like, you know, I'm now able to confront them and sort of meet that challenge.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I think a couple of concepts for me that, you know, I wrote down my notes, like these are just really, really interesting, are you kind of boiled down, you know, the core of a disagreement to like three categories. You label that the head, the heart, and the hand. Mm-hmm. I'd love for you to, if you're up for it, just walk us through, you know, that process and how that's helpful in, you know, when you're in a disagreement, when you're working on solving that disagreement problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is common knowledge. And, you know, in the world of disagreement where, you know, you're at the end of a really frustrating, grueling, unproductive disagreement. And you're like, what was that even about? Right.
Yeah.
Why were we arguing? Or you're in the middle of it and you're like, and someone's saying something and you're like, that's not what this is about. I'm talking about this. And they say like the same thing, like that's not what this is about. It's about this. Well, the three realms are a way to sort of figure out why that happens. You know, sometimes we end up having a conversation that's a disagreement when we're having actually two different disagreements. Mm. And oftentimes one of them is about information. So I consider like the head, like the conflicts of the head as conflicts about information. Like, can I just go out and find this, you know, look it up in a dictionary and find the actual definition of this word? And then the disagreement's resolved. We think all disagreements are like that, but it turns out very few of them are.
Yep.
And so one person oftentimes tries to collapse that disagreement into something that's like about a technical definition somewhere. The biggest one, and sort of like, you know, with the name of your podcast, like, so the heart is about meaning. It's like, mm-hmm. what's important to me? Why is it important to me? You know, what is the story behind this? What are the beliefs, the values, principles, preferences, all that stuff, where you can't actually resolve you know, where the best, you know, hot dog is in your city by going out and like crunching numbers. It's really just a personal preference. And you may not even like hot dogs. And so you're not going to ever convince someone to not like hot dogs if they do. And so if you're in that kind of argument, you shouldn't be trying to resolve it with information. You should be trying to understand their belief system, understand the story, understand, you know, there's a lot of questions in the book about like try to unpack that belief in a way that leads to a really rich conversation. Yeah. Like, you know, how did this belief help you? When is it formed? You know, all these other things. And then the last one, hands, is my favorite one because this is the one that is hardest to describe, but it's about the how. Like, what's the best way for us to, you know, improve the country, like who's the best person to elect and why, and how will we get there? You can't actually resolve that with information. You can't resolve it just by like self-reflection. You have to actually do something and then see what happens and learn from it and then do it again and do it again. And so I consider like the head as the what, the heart as the why, and the hands as the how. And when we're in the heart section, which is oftentimes like I would say like 90% of the time, something about values, it's better to turn it into a conflict of hands, like the how, than about what. You could say like, this is the policy. This is a gun policy that I think that should exist because it's important to me. Rather than saying like, here's statistics about other countries and guns. You could say like, okay, well, let's design a policy and sort of pick it apart and see how it would work and see if we can come to agreements on like the different pieces we're playing around with and then try something and see what works. Mm. And that's actually much easier to resolve, you know, in a really bad disagreement than just tossing around information.
I love it. Yeah. And for whatever reason, just as you're talking about, you know, about going from those concepts to actually putting it into play and seeing how it plays out, it reminded me of what you said about when you're in those places where you're trying to make a decision and you need to like narrow, like instead of looking at just these two options, like you look at the values and expand from there. And I just think it's just interesting, the connection there, to find the meaning and then find the application, I guess.
Yeah. We don't have the language or the courses that teach us these things as young adults or even, you know, mature adults. So it's hard to talk about in a way that doesn't sort of fall into cliche territory sometimes, but you know, in practice, like that's where it can become real. Like just like taking something like a disagreement and saying like, okay, well, let's both come up with this plan and propose something and then see if we have pieces in common and then try it out and see what happens. You know, startups have stumbled on this sort of innovation, I think, you know, to great benefit to them, you know, where you turn into an experiment and see what happens versus arguing about it.
Yeah.
And we can do that in lots of other venues of our life as well.
I love it. I know that another part of the book that really spoke to me, and when I even think about the word disagreement, the first, you know, word that also comes to mind for me is anxiety and like all of the feelings that come up in it. But you talk about the internal voices, which I just love how you just kind of just come out and just name it. But, you know, there's disagreements are not just interpersonal, but they're also, you know, intrapersonal, and that you have like four kind of categories of internal voices that you kind of have to talk to in the midst of a disagreement. I would love for you to just kind of walk us through those. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you're up for it.
Sure. Yeah. So this is, you know, it's an anthropomorphization of our own mind, right? In a lot of ways. So I think of our brains as having multiple voices in them. And oftentimes in an argument, you can imagine yourself like getting into the stage where you're like, you're in a battle and you're just like, you just want to smash the enemy and, you know, you'd be done with it. And like, I call that the voice of power. You know, the voice of power is just like, I'm going to win by being louder, stronger, meaner, whatever it is, just like forcing it to happen.
Yeah.
And it's like the one that we inherited from being an animal, right? Like it's the one that bears do and birds do. And like whoever grabs the berry and flies away with it faster, like gets to eat it. And we, you know, up until even like the 18th century, like a lot of politics, you know, I guess you could say even today, like a lot of politics is just like intimidation and force. And like, you don't get a choice. We're just going to force it on you out of strength.
Yep.
And we have that voice in our head. We go there when we're feeling stressed and like the fight or flight sort of mechanism pops in. The other one, which we oftentimes think is the opposite of power, is reason. Mm. And I think this is a voice that's like, oh, let's prove that this is true or not. Let's go to the evidence. Let's, you know, figure it out through, let's go talk to our boss and figure out, you know, who, what that person thinks. Let's go look up the legal code. Let's take it to court. Mm. All these things. It's like, we're going to invoke some kind of higher authority and then use that system to help us resolve this disagreement. It could be just like, let's flip a coin, or it could be, let's run an experiment.
Yeah.
All these things are delegations to a higher power, but that only works if both sides believe in the same higher power. If one side's like, let's resolve this with, you know, a flip of the coin, other person's like, no, let's resolve this with a sword fight. Like, you're not going to be able to resolve the fact that you have different higher authorities with reason.
Yep.
And we find ourselves in that situation a lot when we're talking across tribes, across ideologies and demographics, where the thing that I use to resolve disagreements is not the one that you use. And who's to say which one is better? Yep. They're both useful in their context. And so we have to come up with another one. And that's why so many of us feel like the third voice is really becoming louder and louder, which is the voice of avoidance. Mm. The voice of avoidance is like, well, I don't want to overpower the person, and reason doesn't seem to work, so I'm just going to do nothing, right? It's sort of this part of our brain that's like, there's only two choices here. Neither of them work. And so I'm going to opt out entirely. I'm just not going to talk about it because it's not going to be productive.
Yep.
And more, I realized, like, as I was sort of running these experiments in my own life, I guess, that more people are in that stage than in the reason stage. But there are some people that are like on Twitter every day, like, you know, battling evil with tweets, right? And then there's a lot of people that are just like shutting down their phones and like turning everything off and avoiding it. And there's a great book by Margaret Heffernan called Willful Blindness about like how this also occurs in the workplace and how most of us know problems that we don't speak up about in every venue of our life. Like 85% of people when surveyed will say like, I know about a problem that I don't feel like safe talking about that impacts the rest of the group. And that's the scariest one, but it's also, I would say, a hopeful one because it's already figured out that power and reason aren't going to work. It just doesn't know what the other options are.
Yeah.
And so that's where the fourth voice comes in for me, is the voice of possibility. Mm-hmm. So asking like, okay, nothing seems to be working. What am I missing? It's like, it's the voice of possibility, curiosity, acknowledging that I don't see everything, that I can't understand everything. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to start, keep on looking. So asking like, what's missing? What else could happen here? And what if we did nothing? All these other questions that can become the third and fourth and the fifth options and might be more viable than the other two. And that will sort of, you know, sort of speaking to like the earlier questions, like open up the playing field to more possibilities and also, you know, helps us move into that state of like reaching out to people instead of shutting them down and trying to understand them instead of trying to project our own biases onto them. Yeah. So those are the four. I definitely advocate for the last one.
Yeah.
When you're feeling stuck, it's like, let's just, instead of going to avoidance and sticking there, let's go to possibility and ask a question. Ask a good question, find the best advocate of the other position that you don't understand and sort of learn from them and come up with a plan to move forward that you could both agree on.
I love that because it's such an invitation to approach a disagreement and someone else's viewpoint in a posture of curiosity. And like, your goal isn't to win. Your goal isn't to change them, but just to learn and discover.
Get unstuck,
And I think that it's inspiring. It feels like that's more of what we need in the world.
Right.
And I think even just before I opened the book, like, I'm like, disagreements, it's just going to, you know, be about, I think the former, about power and reason and, you know, arguing better.
Right.
Even I think some of my, when I first, I saw you, you know, probably a couple of years ago talking about cognitive biases on Twitter. At first I was like, oh, those are like logical fallacies. I don't know that I really want to, you know, I don't know that I want to dig into how to argue better. Like, that's not, you know, obviously that was my misunderstanding, but I think that, yeah, there's just so much goodness that can come and from entering into disagreement with that sense of like, that there's something for me to learn here, not for me to educate or change in the other person.
Exactly. Yeah. And first and foremost, it helps. Like, there's a lot of like that feeling of anxiety and frustration and feeling stuck and all that stuff. Like, that's the thing we're trying to solve, but we're just using the wrong tools to do that. And the tools we're using are just making us feel more stuck. Mm. And so there is this sort of relaxing, this sort of unburdening that you can come across of like, oh, okay, you know, I can now, I'm not a soldier anymore. I can be the explorer. I could be someone that, you know, is going to go about and have some adventures and sort of learn from the world rather than just being the missionary that goes in and like, you know, tries to convert everyone.
Yeah. And I think it feels like it also reduces the anxiety because the point of the disagreement is no longer about whether you win or lose, but whether or not you learn. which right. is like you don't have a dog in the fight as much. You're just observing, I guess. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah, and acting. And we can learn to act in, you know, in ambiguity, right? Like there's always something, we always have to do this. We always have to take what we know and make an educated guess and act. But we can act on the problem instead of acting against the opponent. Mm. And I think that's, you know, we spent all this time arguing about these problems yes. with our opponents,
yes.
but not actually working on the problem.
Yes.
And yeah. So yeah, I it's think like that's a,
totally
the big shift.
Yeah. It's almost like we're arguing about the solutions and not talking about the problem, or you know, mm-hmm. we need to move back up the chain.
Yeah. If we ever did convince everyone that, you know, about our, you know, climate change agenda, we would still have to do all the work. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, you could be working on the problem at the same time. And people are doing this, yep. but they're not the people that you necessarily see in the battles yeah. that are happening.
Yeah. As much, it's not what the headlines are geared towards, because right. the headlines, you know, I think are written to provoke our anxiety and to, you right. know, to get us into the fight or flight stance.
Right.
And what you're advocating for is something different. It's just when you think about the book, what is your hope for, you know, the impact that it would have in the world?
Yeah. Well, what you said earlier was actually very close to the impact that I want. Like, I want people to sort of see that argument isn't a thing to avoid. Mm. I think that's the biggest one mm. and a thing that you can practice, the thing that has like this superpower element to it, where, you know, the more you practice conversation and disagreement and productive disagreement and get like 1%, 5%, 6% better, the more that opens up so many other skills for you. Like so many other parts of your life can now start improving again that have been stuck.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that we do is we see what's happening in the world. We're like, okay, well, who's at the top? They must be doing something wrong, but we don't have a really tangible feeling of like, what should they be doing instead? Mm-hmm. All we know is that somebody else should replace them that fights better than them. And I think if we can practice disagreement and productive disagreement and sort of feel it and experience it, that we will then have the ability to imagine our leaders also having that trait, and mm-hmm. we will expect them to have that trait. And when they run for office, we will vote for them because they have that trait. And I think that's the only way for us to like sort of change the pattern that's happening here, where we're just trying to fight on brute force mm-hmm. and reason, and rather than trying to fight on the realm of like exploration and learning and actually solving problems and expecting people to be good at this, because we have no examples to point to. And therefore we have to be the first example to ourselves and then help from there.
I love it. Well, it's a great vision, and I'm really, really grateful for you to be doing this work and leading us all in this direction. It's a awesome. needed direction.
Thank you.
I think it's worth noting, you know, kind of going back to the beginning of our conversation about, I asked you if you'd always thought you'd be in tech, and you said when you were young, you wanted to be a poet and a novelist, and it almost feels like you've come full circle a little bit. You yeah. did the computer thing. I mean, which obviously, I say it like that, it sounds demeaning. I don't mean it like that.
No.
Obviously still a big part of your life, but like now you're mm-hmm. you're a writer, and like that's kind of your main focus, at least at this very moment. And it's cool to see that who you are is really, you know, coming to fruition here, which is
absolutely.
I don't know. There's not yeah. really a question there as much as just an observation, I guess.
Yeah, and I've certainly enjoyed it. I've worked at lots of places where I've always been like the platform, you know, person, you know, building the platform for creators and people using Twitter and people using Slack and people using, you know, all these other things, Amazon. But now I get to be one of the people, yeah. right? And I love that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to just be building the platform anymore. There's a platform in conversation that I guess I'm trying to build mm-hmm. in a meta way, but yeah. I also get to be a person with beliefs and thoughts as well, which
it.
Is great.
I love it. It's fantastic. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show with me today. I just really, you know, I followed your work for a long time and really appreciate everything that you do. And I know I shared with you before we started recording that my blog was more or less birthed on 750 words. So most of my content has gone through that platform. So I'm very
yeah.
appreciative.
I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation too. Like such, you know, I think it's such an interesting topic, and I always love to hear how other people interpret it and, you know, where people are. So,
I love it.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, if all goes according to plans with my production, this episode should be going live, you know, the week after the book is out. So just love to invite everyone to pick up a copy and check it out. Is there anything else that you would like to invite people to that are interested in following along with you and your work?
Most of the book information, there's going to be some like bonus material and stuff released on my blog, so busterbenson.com. It'll also obviously be linked to from my Twitter account at Buster. So those are the easiest ways to find me, but you know, I'm on the internet, so easy to find.
Beautiful, beautiful. I'll make sure to link up to those in the show notes. And thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much once again, Buster, and thank you for tuning in. You can find links to Buster's work at themeaningmovement.com/Buster. While you're there, drop your email address into one of the subscribe boxes around the site to get the best of what the Meaning Movement has to offer for free in your inbox, including tools, resources, and updates on our upcoming episodes. I want to just take a quick moment to just read this fantastic review that someone left. Minnie Molly is her name. I assume it's a her on iTunes. I've said before, and I know I'm always saying it, just how much I appreciate it when people take the time to leave a review. And I feel like this one is setting the bar really high because it is so elegant. The title is Courageous and Honest, 5 stars. First, just thank you, whoever you are, for leaving this great review. This is what this person has to say. I've listened to 5 interviews and I am hooked. Each interview is packed with powerful stories and inspiring insight on living and working with purpose. I especially appreciate the elements of struggle and uncertainty as a common thread along the path to shaping a meaningful career and finding fulfilling work. I feel that I am on the cusp of a career pivot, and while I'm not sure what that pivot is just yet, listening to this podcast is fueling my courage, my trust in my own intuition, and my desire to stay present and eyes open to the possibilities. So beautifully said. Oh, man. Thank you so much, whoever you are, for leaving this review. And if you, listener, have been moved in any way by the content of this episode or any episode, ask you to take a quick moment to leave a review, as well as how people like you find this show. And I would just be so incredibly grateful. Our music is by Tom Roram. Our artwork is by Eleazar Ruiz. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with you in a couple weeks.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller. Find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first 3 audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.